Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Your Excellency, Judge Loco, Professor Sinha, Professor Ranbir Singh, Ambassador Nay, Professor Narendra Singh, Professor Grever, Professor Verma, Minister Councillor Melgaard, Professor Bergsmo, Excellencies, distinguished guests. It's an immense privilege to be invited to join this company, to be invited to New Delhi in the presence of this company. And in the atmosphere that has seen this week these two stellar judgments of the Supreme Court of India in relation to talaq, and then yesterday the remarkable expression of humanity, or the further such expression in relation to the realm of privacy. His Excellency's remarks have put the whole matter in focus. This is a challenge that we must, as he says, tackle directly. Sensitivity to human need and courage to find or create principled means to respond to it are the hallmark of this gathering. We've received a call, a very personal call, to help identify, develop, and perhaps contribute to the creation of philosophical foundations for the international law of the future, given that such foundations have yet to be put in place. Like the celebrated Appel du General de Gaulle to the French in June 1940, it responds to crisis and can also lead to great things. The previous conferences of immense importance include, of course, in Osnabrück and Münster in 1648, which led to the Peace of Westphalia, still of such importance, as His Excellency has observed, giving rise to the major part of the San Francisco Conference's work, creating the United Nations in 1945, which also had the exception to which he referred, namely bringing state parties to book when they are a threat to international peace and security. The concept of Westphalian territoriality after 369 years requires close examination and, as he says, to reconcile the irreconcilable. Law's problem is always to drag the law into irrelevance to modern conditions, and particularly the case with international law, which, lacking the legislature of international institutions, has nevertheless somehow to define, create, and apply an international criminal law. There has never been a more pressing need to strengthen the foundations of ICL than at a time of the global warming that potentially affects the whole planet and not just the human bits of it. International terrorism, ISIS's performance this year in numbers of attacks and persons killed is greater than last year, despite the attempts to meet it. And then the enormous issue of nuclear proliferation. The trebling to, in just over a decade, to 65.5 million of internal and external refugees expelled from their homes and or their countries evidence human rights problems of the highest order requiring systemic response in both global politics but also international criminal law, which is why we are here today. The selection of New Delhi for this visionary conference is important both practically and symbolically. The common law of India, developed to give effect to the Constitution of India, shows us how scholars and judges can respond to great challenges with the sensitive, expensive, and practical approach from which others of us can learn that has been displayed this week and is in His Excellency's address. I adapt to the present topic of ICL a passage from the judgment of Justices Kumar Ganguly and Singhvi of the Supreme Court of India in Dev Charan and State of Uttar Pradesh of 2011, a leading constitutional case about compulsory acquisition of land. What was said in that case was this: the open-ended nature of our constitution, and I interpolate the same is to be said of a competent international criminal law, needs a harmonious reconciliation between various competing principles and the overhanging shadows of socio-economic reality in this country, and I add, and in the international community. Reconciliation is foundational in this exercise. There could be no sharper contrast between what was said by those judges and what Duff and Green's philosophical foundation of criminal law has to say. I quote, "International criminal law is not the carefully crafted product of a divinely inspired creative moment, but the messy outcome of the variegated shifting forces that determined its historical development." And it's that gulf that we are challenged to help fill. The fact's been recognized by the organizers who've identified the constitutional vacuum and accepted the challenge of responding to it, and have selected you and your topics with care. While the Security Council and the International Law Commission, of whom we have a distinguished chair on my left, and many distinguished scholars and judges have contributed to the process of international lawmaking, ICL remains, as His Excellency has said, immature, and the present Delhi Conference initiative, to quote the grand philosophy, is long overdue. It is to explore the beginnings of principle in the works of classical thinkers, to identify foundational concepts of international criminal law, and to offer guidance for the future. It can provide an intellectual and practical blueprint for where we've come from, where we are, and where you of the new generation can take it. Our concern is not just with abstraction, but with the practical reality of the human construct and condition. What should we, all of us, be doing about it? My generation has not done enough. During the Cold War, there was widespread shrugging of shoulders. Basic principles of ICL were seen as the problem of politicians and of diplomats. We were only briefly exposed to real apprehension of world war, perhaps during the Cuban frisson, when I was reading international law as long ago as 1962. Times have changed. First, as powerfully argued by Kofi Annan, international affairs are no longer the sole prerogative of states and their representatives. He said a United Nations for the 21st century would have to create new partnerships, respond to the needs of individuals, stand for the principle that national sovereignty could never be used as a shield for genocide or gross violations of human rights. It would have to make a difference in the four key challenges of the 21st century. Peace and security, growth with development, respect for human rights, and the rule of law. All the more, these factors require the law of nations to become public international law. The Court of Appeal of England and Wales recognised recently in Belhage and Straw, a case still running in the United Kingdom, I quote, "A fundamental change has occurred within public international law. The traditional view of public international law as a system of law merely regulating the conduct of states among themselves on the international plane has long been discarded. In its place has emerged a system which includes the regulation of human rights by international law, a system of which individuals are rightly considered subjects. A corresponding shift in international policy has also taken place." There's a lot of past tense there, but there's also need for a great deal of futurity. Secondly, the urgency of getting ICL onto a properly principled basis is evident to any follower of current news. In the words of Prince Zayed Raad Al Hussein, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, in a recent address, I quote, "A new era is unfolding before us. We find ourselves in a political earthquake zone. To many of us, it appears the international system would become dangerously unstable. Fresh shocks are opening, unsuspected fault lines. Weight-bearing pillars are in danger of collapse. Our humanitarian colleagues are being asked to do the impossible. As the number and scale of raging conflicts continue to cause immense suffering and force unprecedented numbers of people to flee their homes. Violent groups of inconceivable brutality are still emerging from this furnace of wars, and countries in southern Africa are struggling with catastrophic drought. It is difficult to overstate the gravity of these and other crises which we currently face." He could have written that today. He is echoed by the very experienced new Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres. "Europe's greatest gift to the world was the values of enlightenment." He had overlooked what we've heard about the history 2,000 years BC in this great state. I return to his speech. "Now they're being called into question and under threat. We are seeing the human rights agenda losing ground to the national sovereignty agendas. We see more and more irrational behaviours, including an aggressive nationalism. We now have a multipolar world that will not solve its own problems. A multipolar world without multilateral institutions led directly to the First World War, as we've recalled in recent commemorations. There is now a compelling need to add the force, the full strength of the law to that of diplomacy and other influences which may in combination be able to meet the threats that hang over us, our potential successes, and indeed our very planet. ICL canon must be developed to meet and help dispel them. But who is to make that happen? Who's going to bell the cat? And how? That is the purpose of this conference. It's designed first to examine the past for the light it can cast on future concepts of ICL, and then to present a mighty challenge to each of us and the wider communities from which we come to do justice to the opportunity we have been given to make this event trigger a third and critical phase after Westphalia and 1945 to the law's contribution to international peace and security. The conference has been planned with broad vision and meticulously, as shown by the list of 38 papers continuing in three sections, identifying the intellectual roots of ICL from Plato to today, followed by its foundational concepts and the ultimate values it can protect. The distinguished international universities and other widely representative institutions, among them our hosts, the Indian Law Institute and the Indian Society of International Law and the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs are all to be warmly thanked for their role in the initiative. And it's now a privilege to listen, contribute to and learn from the conference debate, and then to help give effect to its timely, vital and urgent message.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films and publications, go to silrap.org.